From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, lawyers for Detroit's holdout creditors take aim at Kevin Orr and his team.
Basically, they're saying these guys are a bunch of lazy people that had a preconceived goal in mind and didn't even do the basic blocking and tackling analysis.
50 years ago this week, the Beatles came to Michigan.
If you've seen any of the tickets for the show, I mean, the big super good seats were $6.
We talked to the DJ on stage at Olympia with the Beatles.
Every hour for several days, we got reports about we're here, we're doing this, John said this, and Paul said that.
And John Eubakin previews the MSU Oregon game.
That is not a fancy team. It is not a flashy team. It is hard-nosed, old-school, smash-mouth football. And there's at least four cliches for you right there.
September 6th, 1964. The day the Beatles came to Michigan, tens of thousands of fans screaming for John, Paul, George, and Ringo at Olympia Stadium in Detroit. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, DJ Bob Green reflects on the 50th anniversary of the Beatles' first concert in the Motor City. But first, the historic Detroit bankruptcy trial is in its third day. The opening salvos have been fired, and they've begun calling witnesses. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is covering the trial. Daniel, as you put it in your column today, history is unspooling in Judge Stephen Rhodes' courtroom, but you're noting a distinct dearth of public interest?
Yeah, it's surprising. You go into the media overflow room and there's like two people sitting there and a handful of reporters who are just madly tweeting and you know, very quick processing the information. But, you know, there were protesters the first day. There was none really to speak of the second day. And yet it's still very important what's going on here. And I think what was interesting about yesterday, and I think it will become more clear in the trial, is that the city and its bankruptcy team basically didn't do some of the blocking and tackling that some of the creditors say they should have done to reach the grand bargain. They didn't look at, are there alternative ways to raise revenue? They didn't look at, are there alternatives to what to do with the art? They basically said, you know, we didn't look at that stuff. So it's like from the get-go, they said, we're not going to do that. We're going to use the power of the bankruptcy to get this restructuring through and to protect certain things that we deem that needed to be protected, like pensioners and the DIA art.
As you listen to the lawyers representing the city of Detroit and then the two big holdout creditors, Fidjik and Sincora, what struck you as the best and the weakest arguments? Or I guess I'm asking, who made the best case?
Well, I have to tell you that when you sit back and look at it, you want to say that the city did its due diligence and came to the conclusions and that drove the decisions and the positions they took. And what Sincora basically and Fidjik are saying is they didn't even do the work. Basically, they're saying these guys are a bunch of lazy people that had a preconceived goal in mind and didn't even do the basic blocking and tackling analysis to get to the conclusions that they drew. And I think their argument then is that they didn't really do anything in good faith. Now, I think the counter from the city is, well, we don't have to, because you, as a creditor, can't force us to liquidate any assets.
And what about questions and reactions from Judge Rhodes? What did you pick up there?
Well, he, at one point, to the lawyer representing Sincora, asked him, you know, how much does your client need to settle? Now, they were going to get 10 cents on the dollar, and he wouldn't answer, and the judges kept saying, just give me a number. And he finally gave him a number that was actually higher than the retirees are getting, which I think was the point. It was a safe bet, and he said 75 cents. The other thing the judge said I thought was interesting was he said, you've made some very strong arguments here. And essentially what they did was they used statements of city officials, Kevin Orr, Ken Buckfire, their chief investment banker, some of their tax analysts from Ernst & Young, to basically impeach them, in a sense, and say, here are their own people saying, we didn't do these things. We didn't look at other ways to raise money off the art. We didn't even do an analysis as to whether we could raise taxes in some ways without reducing the revenue, because in a lot of cases when the tax rates go up, the tax revenue goes down. And that's been their argument, but they never actually did an analysis to back up their contention that if we raise taxes, revenue will go down. And so I think what they're saying is, you didn't even do the analysis. You just bought this, what's essentially a political argument, without doing the economic analysis to back it up. And so I think when you sit there and listen to it, you kind of say, I wonder if they're going to be on a little bit shaky ground here. If the judge isn't going to say, look, you guys have got to be able to support this. You can't just make a statement and make what amounts to a political argument and a political decision. And that's kind of the way it looked yesterday. Now, we've got a long way to go here, and we're just getting into expert witnesses. I think the city's going to start calling a few today, and we're going to hear from a lot of people. And I think most folks their eyes are going to glaze over as we go forward with some of this stuff, because I don't know how much of it's going to be new.
Yeah, and also for a layperson to try to digest some really heavy financial and legal stuff, it's a little hard to cut through a lot of this.
Well, it really is. And the other thing, too, is in this day and age of online streaming and everything, you can't online stream this. I mean, you can't sit in your house and have it on your iPad or on your laptop. You got to go down there. You got to give up your cell phone and leave it somewhere else. Go through security. Go in there and sit in a room, this vast room, in the dark, and watch it on the screen. And that's about, or go sit in the courtroom. So as a general rule, it's not easy to follow this stuff anyway. And a lot of the arguments, I think, are awfully recycled. I mean, you had two lawyers, one from Syncora, one from FGIC, and they basically were recycling each other's arguments.
Well, it'll be a long haul as we go through at least the next 7 weeks or so following this, but glad to get your expertise. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
It's a big football weekend, especially for Michigan State. The number 7 Spartans head to Oregon to play the number 3 Ducks on Saturday. Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon is here. And boy, this one has sure grabbed a lot of national attention.
Many consider this the best non-conference matchup of the entire season, which is saying a lot, and the Spartans have not been one of those in quite a while.
Coach Mark D'Antonio gave the green light to this game with Oregon, was it some 5 years ago? What kind of statement was he making about where he intended to take the Spartans?
I'll tell you what, that's pure guts, because when he does that in 09, the Spartans started that season 0-4 until they beat Michigan in overtime, which got Rich Rodriguez's team going south and his going north. They were headed nowhere fast, and Oregon was already on top of the football pile, in the top 10 at least. And so that was a lot of guts and a lot of faith, so give the man credit.
What do you feel is at stake, besides getting one in the win column, for MSU and for the Big Ten?
Well, certainly as far as Michigan State goes, if they win this game, they are a top 5 team, maybe a top 4 team. They are now fighting not just for a Big Ten title, but for a national title, which they have not fought for in a long time. But of course, to Big Ten fans, it's almost more important, because after Wisconsin blows a 24-7 lead against also-ranked LSU last weekend, the Big Ten is dying for some credibility. This would be a big pile of it all at once.
And it's interesting, as you read comments from both the coaches, they're both, the public face is both cool as cucumbers. It is, did you notice that?
Oh, yeah. And D'Antonio, by the way, I mean, his face is made of granite in the first place. He's not the most easygoing guy I've met. Tom Izzo, Michigan State basketball coach, is a very funny guy. An Italian guy from the UP can tell a story. D'Antonio, when you get to know him, will tell you maybe one. But he's a whole different personality. However, his team reflects this, as it often does. That is not a fancy team. It is not a flashy team. It is hard-nosed, old-school, smash-mouth football. And there's at least 4 cliches for you right there.
And what are you going to be watching for in that game?
Mainly if Michigan State's defense can stop Oregon's offense. Their quarterback is a Heisman Trophy candidate. And if they can stop him, that's a whole different game.
Now, Michigan is headed to South Bend.
For possibly the last time, maybe ever.
Now, recap the history of this with Notre
Dame. This goes back to 1887. I will not go year by year, I promise. It's a short show. Michigan actually taught Notre Dame how to play football in 1887. They've had an on-again, off-again relationship ever since in every way, a lot of mistrust and so on, but they got it going again in 78. They've played almost every year since 78. Right now, Michigan's got 15 wins of those games, Notre Dame 14, one tie. The all-time winning college percentage, history of college football, Michigan is right now 5/100ths behind Notre Dame. So whoever wins tomorrow will be in the lead in the history of college football. The problem is Notre Dame officially ended this relationship 2 years ago to cancel it after this game on Saturday.
And that was done in a rather awkward way?
I would say so. It's like breaking up by email with your girlfriend. Jack Swarbrick, the Notre Dame AD, handed Dave Brandon, Michigan's AD, a letter before the game within an hour, which legally starts the clock on three games you have to give us warning about before it ends. So they cut off the last three games of the series, 15, 16, and 17. And that was a bit of a surprise for Dave Brandon, which shows you, I think, the relationship between these two can't be that great.
And then what happened last year's game?
Last year, Michigan pulls off a very big win at home under the lights. Yeah. And after the game, the PA announcer played the chicken dance at top volume. And I think everyone in the stadium got the point behind that one. I can tell you this, talking to my Notre Dame friends, they recall that very clearly and they were not too pleased, which is why half an hour ago, Cindy, today, Notre Dame announced they're going to play Ohio State in 2022 and 2023. That is a pretty clear message, let's call that.
Michigan Radio Sports Commentator John U. Bacon. Thanks, John.
Cindy, thank you.
Michigan's largest teachers union said today fewer than 5,000 school employees, or less than 5%, resigned their membership during the August opt-out period. The MEA, Michigan Education Association, made that number public today, even as an administrative law judge ruled that MEA members should be allowed to resign anytime. The ruling would need approval from the Michigan Employment Relations Council before it could be enforced. That ruling was a result of an unfair practices complaint filed by the Mackinac Center for Public Policy on behalf of four MEA members who tried to resign outside the August window. It's seen by many as a key test of Michigan's right to work law. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The kids are back in school, cider mills are opening, and like it or not, the days are getting shorter. Must be a time for a new round of Pure Michigan advertisements. Emily Lawler of MLive is with us now. Emily, time for them to swap out the summer fun commercials for fall?
Unfortunately, you'll be seeing the changing leaves colors in your Pure Michigan advertisement.
So what will Tim Allen be telling us about this year for this crop of fall ads?
You know, they're actually recycling a lot of the ads from previous years that have gone over well. And then also they have some new ads from regional partners. They partner with cities or companies. So, for instance, I know there's going to be a Pure Michigan golf ad going out.
And real importantly, where are these new commercials going to be running?
Right. So in places where people would like to visit Michigan, that includes part of southern Ontario. There's Illinois, Chicago, Indiana, and Ohio. So a lot of the states surrounding us.
Although we do have them on our airwaves, right?
Yep. You'll see Pure Michigan advertisements, too. You know, tourism dollars can come from within the state as well as without the state, I suppose.
And they're doing other things in other markets, aren't they, besides the radio and TV ads? What extra things are being tried?
Definitely. Well, you may have heard about the buses being wrapped in Chicago in Pure Michigan advertisements, and those will be switching over to fall-themed advertisements as well.
I've seen those. It's actually rather fun to see it tootling along State Street with
yeah,
Pure
I
Michigan.
Imagine if you were from Michigan, it'd be fun to see a little piece of your home state when you're in Chicago.
Now, how much is this Pure Michigan advertising budget for fall, Emily?
More than $1 million. I think it's looking at about 1.6, but some of that comes from private partners, not all state money.
And again, who would be some of these private sector partners?
Obviously, the Coca-Cola one was probably pretty high profile a couple summers ago. Things like that. Also, I mentioned the Golf Association, just people who basically want to promote their activity in Michigan.
Overall, has Pure Michigan been worthwhile for the state in terms of the money spent and then the money returned from tourism?
There's a little bit of a debate to be had over that, but according to the MEDC's most recent study, they said that the most recent number is that for every dollar we spend on Pure Michigan advertising, there's about $6.66 that comes back in return to our economy. It may seem like an inauspicious number, but that number has gone up every year, according to the MEDC's study.
And I guess as long as it is, we'll keep hearing Tim Allen and Rachel Portman's beautiful music playing at us.
I'm looking forward to it.
Emily Lawler with MLive. Thanks so much, Emily.
Thank you.
50 years ago this week, the familiar sounds of the Detroit Red Wings playing at Olympia Stadium gave way to something completely different. That is the sound of 30,000 teeny boppers screaming for John, Paul, George, and Ringo. Somewhere under all of that, you can hear the Beatles playing Can't Buy Me Love. September 6, 1964, the Beatles came to Michigan. They played two shows at Olympia Stadium. And my next guest was right there, watching and being part of Beatlemania unfolding in Detroit. Bob Green was a disc jockey on WKNR Keener 13, the legendary Detroit radio station that brought the Beatles to Olympia. Bob Green joins us now from Houston. It is good to hear your voice again, Bob Green.
Hello there, Cindy. Nice to talk to you today.
Bob, do you remember the very first time you heard the Beatles?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I do. And there's so many disc jockeys around the country who are claiming that I was first to play the Beatles. And I'm not sure that I was first, except for one thing. It happened in 1962. Before Keener, I was at WQAM in Miami, Florida. And I used to like to listen to shortwave radio when I'd go home sometimes. And I had the BBC on my shortwave radio, and they came up with this new song by a group called The Beatles. And I sort of was half listening. And it was Please, Please Me, by the way, was the song. Capitol had not yet, you know, put out the song that became the first American hit. But there was Please, Please Me. And I thought, gee, they have wonderful sound. There's something about that sound. And the next morning, I went into the station and looked through the junk file. We used to get all kinds of 45s in every day from somebody, and there it was. It was there. We hadn't noticed it. We hadn't seen it. And this was 1962. Let's see. I'm trying to think the end of the year. We played it on WQAM and got some pretty good reaction, and nobody had heard of the Beatles. So I'm not sure that I was necessarily first, but we were pretty early.
I would say that was definitely the vanguard. And then, of course, we went through all of 1963, and it was such a traumatic time in American history with the assassination of President Kennedy. And then the
exactly.
following February, America really discovered the Beatles. That February 1964, with the three consecutive Sundays, they were on the Ed Sullivan Show. Now, were you at Keener by that point, Bob?
Yes, by that time I was at Keener. We were getting set up for opening up Keener. Of course, it had been WKMH in Detroit. And they changed the call letters and decided to do what really had to be done at that point in Detroit radio. So we opened there. We really started on Halloween night of 1963.
And when did Keener start playing the Beatles?
Well, I'm trying to think. Remember, when Kennedy was assassinated, we had to stop everything and we had to start all over again. We became a news station for 4 days and then said, okay, we got to start the new format over again. And so we actually started Keener over again. At that point, probably within 2 weeks, we played the first Beatle record.
What was the listener reaction when you really started hitting it and hitting it hard, and particularly after people discovered the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show? What did you hear?
Well, of course, the demographics of the station were fairly young and a lot of females, and they certainly had a crush on these guys, the way they looked, the way they sounded. I think it took people perhaps a couple of months anyway, maybe more than that, to really determine that, hey, these guys, not only are they a phenomenon, but they also really have some interesting chords and interesting things that they do instrumentally. And, you know, it was discovered that they were more than just a fad. They were really something special.
And then through that summer, they made the movie A Hard Day's Night. And then it was time to get the Beatles out on the road and tour North America. Do you remember, Bob Green, what went on behind the scenes to get the Beatles to make Detroit part of their first tour?
I do, but I don't. I can't recall exactly, but I will say this, if it's part of what happened in Detroit, and that is, when it was all said and done, we were offered, and I won't even give the guy's name, but somebody dealing with our station was offered the possibility of bringing them, and we ended up giving it to somebody else who I don't recall who it was, but the station, even though we emceed the show and we were involved in the show, we did not bring in the group. But here's the interesting thing. When they came to Detroit, they came to the executive hangar at Metro Airport. The other stations in town, which were top 40, were WJBK, WXYZ, and CKLW. And here we had four rock stations playing the Beatles. But we were the only ones that came to that executive hangar. Everybody else went to the other side of the airport. So we were the only ones there to greet them when they came out of their airplane.
That is something. So here they land in Detroit, and I know that they came from Chicago, and the Detroit fans were waiting to out-scream the Chicago fans. Do I recall that they stayed at the Whittier Hotel on East Jefferson?
They did. You are correct.
Why not right downtown? They wanted to keep those fans out?
We couldn't figure out why they stayed at the Whittier for many reasons. Didn't think it was that fancy of a place to stay. And as far as where they were, they had to have a police escort, you know, taking them to the concert. And so we really couldn't figure out exactly why. And I never did find that out. We did have someone traveling on their Flying Tiger airplane, though, by the name of Larry Kane. And Larry gave us reports every hour for several days. We got reports about we're here, we're doing this. John said this and Paul said that. And so we had that exclusivity there.
Now, they were escorted to Olympia. There were two shows with a press conference in between the two shows. And
right.
Where were you as the shows were actually going on, Bob Green?
We were backstage and I introduced them. For 1964, I introduced the Beatles. In 1966, on the return, Scott Regan introduced the Beatles. We were up there, as I recall, Ted Clark, Jim Jeffries, a couple of the other disc jockeys were up there talking for a while to sort of fill time. If you can imagine trying to fill time, people said, get the hell off the stage. We want the Beatles. But anyway, we did introduce them, and we were backstage, and we had had a contest on WKNR to have two winners backstage to meet the Beatles. This is one of the little stories about the Beatles. And we had two winners, two young gals, you know, getting them backstage to meet the Beatles. And one of our competitors, WXYZ, had a new disc jockey at that time named Joey Reynolds. And Joey got on the air, and we heard it. At that time, I was very possessive of our station. Nobody dares to say something about us that's not true. And he was saying, it'll never happen. Keener cannot get you backstage because they won't allow it. And he was talking to some girl on the east side of Detroit where our signal wasn't so good. And I remembered her name. And the next morning I thought, I've got to call that girl. And I think I'll invite her to come backstage to meet the Beatles, even though that was, you know. But anyway, we finally did find out who she was. And she indeed was the third person who I took backstage. And that area of town that we were so weak in because of our signal at WKNR, suddenly the new ratings came out, and boy, did we have that east side of Detroit covered because it got out that we did this for this girl.
So. Tell us, what were John, Paul, George, and Ringo like, especially as you bring these young fans back, because this was all right. New to them.
Right, exactly. You know, they were so much like what people thought they were like in the beginning. You take John, rather acerbic. Obviously, hey, this guy's got a pretty good brain. This guy's pretty sharp. But he always had something a little bit acerbic to say. Then you would take Paul, and Paul was just so outgoing and so funny and smiling all the time and interested and you know, available to say hi, how are you, shake hands, whatever. Ringo, quite quiet, didn't have a lot to say at that time. And then, of course, George was the quiet Beatle, who, of course, we discovered later was also quite a bright and brilliant musician, certainly. But he was quite, you know, quiet. So really, the guy who came to the forefront as far as anybody meeting him would have been Paul McCartney, because Paul was very outgoing.
And isn't it something? That hasn't changed.
No.
I'm speaking with Bob Green. He's my guest today on Stateside. And in September 1964, Bob was there emceeing. He was a disc jockey for WKNR Keener 13, the Detroit area station, and he was the MC to introduce the Beatles as they came to Olympia for their first Michigan appearance. Two concerts 50 years ago this week. In between the shows, there was a press conference. Let's listen to a bit as Detroit reporters meet the Fab Four.
How do you like Detroit so far?
Great.
Well,
we've seen very little. The show we enjoyed.
Thanks.
No, we come here to play, not to see.
Yeah, guys, which artist or musical group do you think has most influenced your music?
Nicky Cuff.
Nicky Cuff, I'd say. No, American coloured groups, mainly, and early Elvis Presley.
In fact, the Detroit sound.
When Elvis was
in fact, yes.
In fact, yeah. Tamla Motown artists are our favourites. The Miracles, The Impressions, Marvin Gaye,
Tam,
Mary Wells,
The Excitement,
Major Lambs, to name but 80,
Chuck Jackson.
Haven't a clue. Don't mind, you know.
Probably won't last that long, though, will it?
No.
That's something when he gets asked, how long do you think it'll last? And John said, haven't a clue. And Bob,
haven't a clue. Well, that's right.
When you look back from that perspective of 50 years, you know, you think about, these were four youngsters. I looked it up. John was 23, Paul 22, Ringo 24, George was just 21.
Yes.
We don't generally recognize watershed moments when we're in the moment. Would you have thought that 50 years later they are still true music icons?
Well, you know, I don't want to say, oh, yes, of course I knew. None of us knew for sure, but certainly we knew that musically they had something very, very special. And it's funny, within 6 months of the Beatle concert, we emceed the Rolling Stones, and in my infinite wisdom, I looked at everybody and said, you know, I don't think these guys will ever last. So it goes to show you that we didn't always cut it. We didn't always realize what we were dealing with. But I think when it comes to the Beatles, we knew that no matter how long they did or did not last, the music, you know, would certainly be around as great golden oldies. And I think it's a lot more than that, obviously, but at least that much. Their music is just too good. They have too many interesting things that they put into it, and I think they're going to last. So that's the way I felt.
Well, we were actually all talking about this story over the weekend that I was going to be talking with you, and someone wondered how many of today's young breakout stars will have people talking this way about them a half a century later. I mean, it's hard to know.
Absolutely. Of course, I can't claim to know a heck of a lot about today's music. I don't follow it the same way I did then.
Well, just to show how times have changed, did I read correctly that the show, each of these two shows, was 20 minutes long?
25. You're right. It was close to 20. It was a little over. I think it was 25, but whatever. A few more minutes here or there. Yeah, but then on the other hand, the if you've seen any of the tickets for the show, I mean, the big super good seats were $6, and then you could have $3 for a seat that's back a little further.
And I just have to go on record now as saying that my mother wouldn't let me go. I was in sixth grade, a new sixth grader, and they said no, just no.
Yeah.
And I know Barbie De Palma up the street got to go, and my mother has been in heaven for a few years, but she still has some explaining to do someday as to why she didn't let me go to that. But it is interesting when you think about $5-6 for that top ticket. I have another full disclosure, Bob Green. I was one of the Keener faithful. And my first time ever on the radio was playing Keener DJ Football on your show in 1965.
Oh,
I won a $10 check, and I couldn't have been more thrilled. So thank you for the memories and for Keener and all you did. And
well, you did better than a Keener ballpoint pen. Of course, the losers got a pen. And sometimes the pen was worth more than the prize. But
so one final question, Bob Green. Do you have a favorite Beatles song?
Oh, that's really tough. There are so many. I think one song that I enjoy a lot, that I liked, and it was a song that they did not play at concerts by nature of the instrumentation. It had violins and whatever in it. And I think that would be Eleanor Rigby.
That was a beauty. That was indeed.
Yeah.
Bob Green, wonderful to talk with you. Thank you very, very much for sharing these wonderful memories from 50 years ago.
Thank you so much.
Bob Green was a disc jockey on WKNR Keener 13, and he was on stage introducing the Beatles as they came to Olympia Stadium in Detroit 50 years ago this week.
Love me do.
WKNR produced a special feature commemorating that Beatle visit to Michigan, and we have a portion of that special, thanks to Bob Green. It includes the raw audio of the Beatles speaking at that press conference, audio that hasn't been heard in some 50 years. We have it up now on our Facebook page. Just search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty, and on the website, michiganradio.org, and click the link that says Stateside. Folks have been waiting for those garden tomatoes all summer long. Stay tuned. We're going to find out what's up with dark, nasty-looking spots on your tomato plants and whether anything can be done to save them. That's coming up in 15 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I love you. I'll always be true. So please. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Fresh faces, fresh voices, fresh ideas, and more diversity. That's what both the Democrats and the GOP say they're looking for, hoping to attract voters in a nation becoming more diverse by the day. Stephanie Chang could certainly move the diversity meter in Lansing. Chang is a Democrat, and she won the primary in the Michigan 6th House District in southwest Detroit. And in that heavily Democratic district, it seems to set her up to win the seat in November, thus making her the first Asian-American woman to serve in the state legislature. Stephanie Chang, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much.
Stephanie, you're the daughter of immigrants from Taiwan. Your district, the 6th, is predominantly African-American. How much do you believe race and ethnicity did play into that primary race?
You know, I think that what I learned throughout this whole campaign is that ultimately people want someone who's going to work really hard for them and someone who shares their values and someone who they can trust. So, you know, I honestly did not get hardly any questions about my race. I mean, some people, I think, were curious. You know, when I was deciding whether or not to run, this was a question that I had, and I asked a lot of people about it. You know, I'm Asian American, the idea of serving a predominantly African American district, is that a problem? You know, and I think there's a couple things that people told me. One, just what I said, you know, the fact that people really want someone they can trust and that someone's going to work really hard. But also this district has a long history of diverse representation. Our current state rep is Rashida Tlaib, who is Palestinian-American. Before her was Steve Tabachman. Before him was Belda Garza. And you know, we've also had Ilona Varga, who is Hungarian. And we also had McNeely, who was one of the first African-American folks in the state legislature who held the leadership position. So we have a long history of diverse representation for this district, and I am a continuation of that.
I want to get back to what convinced you as a 30-year-old Asian-American woman to say, all right, I'm going to do it. I'm going to run for office. Why?
Yeah, so I had actually been working as a community organizer for about a decade in Detroit, working on issues like affirmative action, voting rights, reforming our justice system. I helped start up a community-based elementary school. Running for office, honestly, wasn't something that I saw for my, you know, some people had asked me, have you ever thought about running for office? I was like, maybe, I don't know. When I was asked to run by Rashida Tlaib and other friends of mine, you know, initially I said no a few times, actually, because I really thought that I needed to continue on my path of being an organizer in the community and being an advocate on civil rights and social justice issues. And ultimately what I realized was that I can continue being an organizer on issues that I care about, but this time by serving in the legislature and using those skills that I have. So I'm really excited about putting that to use. You know, it was a six-month process, actually, of deciding whether or not I wanted to run. Initially, I said no, and then eventually I realized I should probably give it some more serious consideration. So over the course of 6 months, I met with a number of friends and mentors and just really realized that this is an amazing opportunity to make a difference in a bigger way for this district. So, you know, it took a while, but eventually I got there.
Now, you knocked on a lot of doors and you probably wore out a lot of shoe leather in that primary campaign. What kind of reaction did you get from voters? What did you hear? What's on their minds?
Yeah, so I started door knocking in March, and when it was 20-degree weather, and continued on all the way up until Election Day on August 5th. And so I actually personally knocked on doors across the entire district twice. And what I heard from people, it was, first of all, there are some things that are specific to some neighborhoods. But across the board, you know, the things that I heard were blight, so abandoned houses, and safety were absolutely the number one and number two things that I heard across the board, across the entire district, things that people want me to work on. But in addition, you know, when I talk to people about, you know, I really want to work on education issues, I want to work on strengthening our social safety net and reversing a lot of the cuts that have been made in this current administration, people, you know, were very enthusiastic about that as well. In some areas of the district, environmental justice and pollution issues are definitely at the top of some people's minds. So there are some issues that were specific to some neighborhoods. You know, the district is very large. It goes all the way over to Indian Village on the east side and all the way southwest to River Rouge and Ecorse. So there were, you know, it includes many, many neighborhoods and with a lot of different issues. But I think there are some common things that we see. And a lot of it, honestly, is quality of life issues as well, whether it be basic city services, getting streetlights back on, you know, reporting illegal dumping sites, you know, all these types of things that we need to do a better job of.
Stephanie, you are a millennial. It appears you are on your way to join a group that has been dominated by older white men. How do you plan to operate as a lawmaker?
You know, I think the same way that I've operated as an organizer. I'm someone who likes to bring people together. Most of the issues that I've worked on have been bipartisan coalitions where people come together around a common issue that might not work together on other issues ever. Whether it be affirmative action or reforming Michigan's public defense representation system, I've been a part of groups where people have come together. I think that, yes, I am young. I believe that I wouldn't actually be the youngest, but I am one of the youngest. And I think that as an organizer, I always asked a lot of questions, did a lot of listening, and I'm someone who is not afraid to speak up for what I believe in, but I'm also someone who is pretty good at getting along with all types of different people. And I think that putting those organizer skills to use will serve me well in the legislature.
Stephanie Chang, Democratic candidate for the State House from the 6th District in Southwest Detroit. Thanks for speaking with us today, Stephanie.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.
This is the future.
You built a time machine out of a DeLorean.
It's alive.
It's the sound of science.
Imagine being able to wear a small sensor just like a bandage. You don't even know it's there. And that little sensor could detect vapors from your body that could come from anemia, diabetes, lung disease. That breakthrough is on the way thanks to a team of researchers at the University of Michigan. Sherman Fan is a professor of biomedical engineering at U of M. Professor, we're all pretty familiar with wearable technology like Google Glass, the Apple iWatch, the Fitbit. But this sensor you and your team are working on takes this to a whole different level, correct?
It's right, because typically the sensor you're talking about, we call it the physical sensors. You're talking about like a blood pressure measurement. But in our case, actually, we're measuring vapors, which is a sort of a chemical measurement.
So things that, as I'm breathing, it's picking things up, or does it actually come out of the skin?
Both, actually.
That is amazing. How does it work?
Basically, we are using so-called micro gas chromatography technology in combination with graphene technology. So micro GC, which stands for gas chromatography, is a way to separate gas molecules before detection. And the graphene is a sort of a nano-electronic sensor or vapor sensors, which can be embedded into these GC channels, and to pick up different vapor molecules and to look at at very low concentration.
So I kind of remember way back in mm-hmm. science class where we had like a chromograph. So it's that concept where you're able to pull out molecules.
Yes, exactly. This concept, I mean, chromatography technology has been around for many years. However, it's usually the technology, I mean, the instrument is very large, very big. It cannot be portable, cannot be even wearable. And so our type, because of the modern technology's advancements, and so we can shrink everything down to something very, very small.
And so you're literally, the idea of a bandage, it could be like that. A doctor could give a patient something that they could slap on and not even be aware that they're wearing it?
Currently, actually, we're working on probably something around like watch size. So they probably still, they know they are wearing something, but it can be as small as a watch.
And so you could test for health issues, such as what?
Such as asthma and maybe diabetics later on, and some other diseases like lung cancer monitoring, cystic fibrosis.
And also there's probably environmental concerns that could be watched for.
True, yes. If you really want to detect something around you, like air quality and any toxic material substances in this room, you should be able to detect it. And also for foot soldiers, usually they carry very heavy equipment, and anything light, that'll be very, very useful for them.
So what needs to happen to get this wearable vapor sensor out into the marketplace?
Basically, I think the first is technology. So whether or not we can integrate everything into a watch size, that's something we're working on right now, and it's quite promising. Second thing is sort of like a clinical validation. So whether or not those vapor molecules are clinically relevant. There's a research going on worldwide using different vapors, so-called vapor biomarkers, to see whether or not those vapor markers are related to certain disease or certain conditions of diseases. And so we are still working on it. We are working with engineers. We are working with clinical doctors and to combine all those expertise and to make this to happen.
So what's your best guess? How long do you think this could take to actually get this out and available to patients?
I also depend on which applications you are talking about. For just environmental monitoring and for probably like a chemical warfare agent monitoring or detection, this one doesn't need clinical validation. So in this case, I would say probably a couple of years. And for the biomedical applications, usually, you know, it takes a very long time because we have to be make sure it, you know, it's safe and also it can provide a clinical information.
That's useful.
That is useful, can be used by doctors to make decisions. And in this case, actually, probably it's going to take a little bit longer time.
It has to be exciting, though, when you are working away with your team and thinking of the kind of impact that this vapor sensor could have really in human health around the world.
We have a team. I know I'm working with another professor at the W department, Zhao Huizhong. And 2 years ago, we got together and talked about this idea. And we were both very excited. And later on, we tried really hard with our graduate students. And we published the paper. And recently, we were funded by NSF grants and to pursue in both fundamental research side and also the some application, for example, like wearable vapor sensors.
Well, a sense of really science happening in the trenches, the foot soldiers who are really making these kinds of technological advances that ultimately could mean so much for human health and welfare. Sherman Fan, a professor of biomedical engineering at the University of Michigan, he and his team are developing a new wearable vapor sensor that could offer nonstop disease monitoring. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. What is the deal with the tomatoes? There are dark, nasty-looking lesions popping up on tomato plants and the tomato fruit all over the state. It turns out Michigan's tomatoes are now catching the very same disease that wiped out the Irish potato crop in the 1840s. It's called late blight. Mary Hausbeck is a professor in the plant pathology department at Michigan State University. So, Mary, what is happening to these tomatoes?
Well, late blight is caused by a microorganism, and this particular microorganism really enjoys cool, wet conditions. And these are exactly the type of summer conditions that we have had this year. Typically, and it can happen almost every year, that this late blight pathogen is brought in on infected potato tubers. And that usually can be just to a very, very small percentage of tubers that carry the pathogen. And in a normal Michigan summer, that pathogen is of little consequence because that particular microorganism that causes late blight really does not like hot, dry conditions, which oftentimes we have for at least a good part of the summer. But in this case, the late blight pathogen was likely introduced on a very small percentage of potato tubers that, of course, are used to initiate the potato crop in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then, you know, lo and behold, what do we have but these cool, wet conditions that allow that pathogen to spread and thrive. And then it has these microscopic spores that then can travel via air currents to homeowners' tomatoes. And that's exactly what has happened. And then once the tomatoes become infected with this late blight, spores from those infected tomato plants can then spread to nearby tomato plants, creating this epidemic.
So if I walk out, look at my tomatoes, and I see black spots on the leaves or on the tomatoes, is that it? There's nothing that can be done?
Well, actually, this particular late blight causes more of a stem rot initially, and then this almost overwhelming kind of blight, which is a term that talks about a lot of tissue being infected at once. And so some of our more commonly occurring tomato diseases that we have each year that growers are kind of used to and they know that they can survive them tend to be more spots where this blight actually infects a good part of the stem, which blackens it, which is very unusual to what homeowners are used to seeing. And this blackening also affects green tomato fruit, which our typical maladies don't affect the green fruit, and then the red fruit as well, and it causes these large areas of rotted fruit. And if you are at the stage of seeing any of that, really, you know, I think it's best to set your sights on next growing season.
Now, what if I don't have that? Can I, as a homeowner, buy something that might protect my plants?
You can. There are products that have what you would look for is on the active ingredient list. It's a product called chlorothalonil. And again, that is chlorothalonil. It's spelled almost the way that it sounds. And you would have to look at the active ingredient. That's the tiny, tiny print. And on the active ingredient list, you would see something that would say chlorothalonil, and then you'd also see a list of inert ingredients. And that is the only product that I'm aware of that is available to homeowners that could be used. It probably would need to be used at least, I would say, every 7 days at this point. This disease is widespread, though, and so I think many homeowners really are seeing the beginnings of this blight.
And if I have these infected plants in my backyard, and you've talked about how easily these spores spread, what should I be doing with these plants to keep it from spreading further?
You know, really the best thing to do is to pull the plant up or simply prune the plant at its base and then put all the above-ground parts into a trash bag. Seal the trash bag and put it out with your ordinary trash. You know, the good news of all of this mess is that this pathogen does not overwinter in Michigan soils, and so there's no reason for our tomato gardeners to think that if they were wiped out this year, there's no reason to think that they cannot come back in next spring and have a fabulous garden with lots of healthy tomatoes.
That's reassuring. Mary Hausbeck, professor in the Plant Pathology Department at Michigan State University. Mary, thanks so much for talking with us.
All right, thank you.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our director today was Allie Billings, and our engineer is Bob Scon. Contributors are Mike Blank, Michelle Hahn, and Annie Norris. Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.